Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the reading and sermon from our February 28th service. The sermon is Poetry as a Spiritual Practice by Ellen Bass. Thanks for listening.
I'd like to offer this poem in sympathy. It's called The Thing Is. The thing is to love life. To love it even when you have no stomach for it. And everything you've held dear crumbles like burnt paper in your hands, your throat filled with the silt of it. When grief sits with you, its tropical heat thickening the air, heavy as water, more fit for gills than lungs. When grief waits you, like your own flesh, only more of it, an obesity of grief. You think, how can a body withstand this? Then you hold life like a face between your palms, a plain face, no charming smile, no violet eyes. And you say, yes, I will take you. I will love you again. Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. Really appreciate that Bruce and Joseph invited me, and I feel like I've been here before, but maybe because my poems traveled ahead of me, and also because I read some of the sermons and looked around on the website and thought, oh, this is Poetry Church. So I feel very at home, even though this is my first time here. Thank you so much. I want to begin with these. I'm going to talk a little bit about poetry and read a few poems. And I want to begin with these lines from D.H. Lawrence, his poem. This is the end of his poem, Song of a Man Who Has Come Through. He says, "What is the knocking? What is the knocking at the door in the night? It is somebody wants to do us harm. No, no, it is the three strange angels. Admit them, admit them." So at first we are, if you're like me, always afraid. And then we know that what life can bring is terrifying. We know it all too well this morning. But we also know that when we open the door to the beauty and pain of life, to all of it, the laughter, the desire, the brutality, the tenderness, we don't miss out on the experience of being alive. And even if we have a very long lifespan, it's very short. And we're always searching for ways to make that time meaningful. And one of the most basic ways is to actually be present for our lives while we're here. Not to let our days go by without noticing the small pleasures, the big joys, and also not to try to skip over the pain and the sorrow. Not to think of those parts as having no reality. The French novelist Colette said, "What a wonderful life I've had I only wish I realized it sooner. In my most recent book, Like a Beggar, I begin with an epigraph from Rainer Maria Rilke. He says, "Oh, tell me, poet, what do you do? I praise. But those dark, deadly, devastating ways, how do you bear them, suffer them? I praise." And this praise is the practice of being open to our lives, by which we can be more deeply, more acutely awake to this human experience. As the philosopher Simone Weil said, absolute attention is prayer. And you probably know that poetry had its roots in religion as a ritual for both celebration and lamentation. So we're in a long tradition here. In poetry, we are praising even as we grieve, and we're aware of the inevitability of loss even as we rejoice. So this is the essential tension of poetry, and it's the essential tension of life. How do we praise the world and be simultaneously aware of all its suffering? And how can we enlarge our capacity for holding this depth and complexity? Our capacity to savor the moment, even when we know that the very next moment may bring disappointment or even disaster. When I planned what I was going to read, this next poem, I chose this next poem, and as I thought about it this morning, in light of this recent tragedy, I thought maybe I shouldn't read it, and then I thought a little more, and I thought that I would, because it has humor in it, and I think that for me that's not separate from grief. And some of the ways that I have gotten through tough times have been with humor pressed up against the pain. I seem to have a particular attraction to that, of pain and humor together. I know that works for some of us. And so this poem is called Relax. Bad things are going to happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus, and your cat will get run over. Someone will leave the bag with the ice cream melting in the car, and throw your blue cashmere sweater in the dryer. Your husband will sleep with a girl your daughter's age, her breasts spilling out of her blouse. Or your wife will remember she's a lesbian and leave you for the woman next door. The other cat, the one you never really liked, will contract a disease that requires you to pry open its feverish mouth every 4 hours. Your parents will die. No matter how many vitamins you take, how much Pilates, you'll lose your keys, your hair, and your memory. If your daughter doesn't plug her heart into every live socket she passes, you'll come home to find your son has emptied the refrigerator, dragged it to the curb, and called the used appliance store for a pickup. Drug money. The Buddha tells a story of a woman chased by a tiger. When she comes to a cliff, she sees a sturdy vine and climbs halfway down, but there's also a tiger below. And two mice, one white, one black, scurry out and begin to gnaw at the vine. At this point, she notices a wild strawberry growing from a crevice. She looks up, down, at the mice, then she eats the strawberry. So here's the view, the breeze, the pulse in your throat. Your wallet will be stolen. You'll get fat. Slip on the bathroom tiles in a foreign hotel and crack your hip. You'll be lonely. Oh, taste how sweet and tart the red juice is. How the tiny seeds crunch between your teeth. I wrote this poem as I was emerging from what I hope will be the worst period of my life. And one of the gifts of poetry is that it's a space in which you can be a witness to your life. You can step back, not really far, not so far that you're in denying your life or pushing it away from you, but also not so close that it's smothering you. And you get a chance to have just that little bit of distance, just the right amount. You can take your pain, your losses, your sorrows, your rage, and approach them with curiosity instead of just trying to make them go away. The poet John Berryman said, "The artist is extremely lucky who is presented with the worst possible ordeal which will not actually kill him. At that point, he's in business." Being present for our most painful experiences is a challenge for all of us, but there's a depth of living that comes from that presence that is perhaps the only true consolation for the pain. Many years back when I was young, I read a book by a woman in her 80s, Florida Scott Maxwell, called The Measure of My Days. She said, "You need only claim the events of your life to make yourself yours. When you truly possess all you have been and done, which may take some time, you are fierce with reality." I would like to read you this poem called "Waiting for Rain." Finally, morning. This loneliness feels more ordinary in the light, more like my face in the mirror. My daughter in the ER again. Something she ate, some freshener someone spritzed in the air. "They're trying to kill me," she says, as though it's a joke. Lucretius got me through the night. He told me the world goes on, making and unmaking. Maybe it's wrong to think of better and worse. There's no one who can carry my fear for a child who walks out the door not knowing what will stop her breath. The rain they say is coming sails now over the Pacific in purplish nimbus clouds, but it isn't enough. Last year I watched elephants encircle their young, shuffling their massive legs without hurry, flaring their great dusty ears. Once they drank from the snowmelt of Kilimanjaro. Now the mountain is bald. Lucretius knows we're just atoms combining and recombining. Stardust, flesh, grass. All night I plastered my body to Janet, breathing when she breathed. But her skin, warm as it is, does, after all, keep me out. How tenuous it all is. My daughter is coming home next week. She'll bring the pink plaid suitcase we bought at Ross. When she points it out to the escort pushing her wheelchair, it will be easy to spot on the carousel. I just want to touch her. Arthur Rubinstein said, "Of course, there is no formula for success except perhaps an unconditional acceptance of life and what it brings." This is hard to do. We want what we want, and we don't want what we don't want. When we get what we don't want, it's difficult for us to accept that. Someone told me this Buddhist prayer some years back that enraged me. It says, "I am a human being, and anything that can happen to human beings can happen to me today, and I accept that." And my first thought was, no, 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 no. And I don't expect to ever get in this lifetime to where I can truly say that prayer and mean it. But I am trying to inch just a little tiny bit closer each year. And I wrote this poem, Prayer. Once I wore a dress liquid as vodka. My lover watched me ascend from the subway like I was an underground spring breaking through. I want to stop wanting to be wanted like that. I'm tired of the song the rain sings in June, the chorus of hope, the ravenous green. The earth, her ornate crown of trees spiking up from her loamy head. There are things I wanted, like everyone. But to this angel of wishes I've worshipped so long, I ask now to admit the world as it is. Poetry is rooted in metaphor, in which we see the similarity, the oneness, in disparate things. The best metaphors are there not just for decoration, but because they're the only way to say it. It isn't possible to reduce all of our emotions and our thoughts to direct statements and communicate beyond the most superficial level. Much of what we're trying to talk about in poetry is the mystery. And we're always searching for ways to speak not just to our very sophisticated minds, but to our hearts, our bodies, our spirits. And they listen and vibrate on a different wavelength than our more conscious, rational brains do. So metaphor is a way to use words to get underneath words, to say the unsayable. Our society has become very sophisticated in its ability to differentiate between things, to make very fine distinctions, and some of that is marvelous, all of what we learn through science and other ways to see very, very precisely. But in poetry, we're also being reminded of similarities. Poetry is essentially metaphor. Things which are commonly thought of as different are revealed to be in some essential way similar. We say this is like that. And when it's true, when it's accurate, barriers collapse and we get a glimpse into the oneness of the world. Aristotle said way back that to make good metaphor is holy labor. And I wanted to read you a poem that has metaphor in it. When I was coming, preparing to do this sermon, Joseph gave me a tip. He said that when you give a sermon, you should speak to four people. One has just received the worst news. One has just received the best news. One is going to be leaving the congregation, and one has just come to the congregation. And I thought that was quite wonderful. And I was thinking, well, I would read a happy poem for the ones that have just gotten the best news. This poem is called Gate C-22. Takes place in the Portland airport, and I just want to share with you the backstory of this poem. I was, my family and I were delayed for a flight, and I got very worked up about it, even though there was no good reason to be worked up, because I really didn't need to be anywhere at a particular time. But I have a tendency to do that sometimes. And so I'm running from one ticket counter to another, trying to get in front of all the other people who might want to get on a different flight too, only I'm more aggressive about it. I'm one of those people that you sometimes see in the airport and kind of sigh to yourself, like, you know, what has gotten into that person? And as I'm running back and forth and making no progress, I fortunately get a chance to see this scene, to witness this scene that I then get a chance to write about, which becomes kind of a hit single poem. And now whenever I'm delayed in airports, I don't get quite so worked up, and I start looking around because I think maybe I'm going to like catch another poem there. So I have learned a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit. But I'll share this with you. It's Gate C-22. It's a true story. At Gate C-22 in the Portland airport, a man in a broadband leather hat kissed a woman arriving from Orange County. They kissed and kissed and kissed. long after the other passengers clicked the handles of their carry-ons and wheeled briskly toward short-term parking, the couple stood there, arms wrapped around each other like he'd just staggered off the boat at Ellis Island, like she'd been released at last from ICU, snapped out of a coma, survived bone cancer, made it down from Annapurna in only the clothes she was wearing. Neither of them was young. His beard was gray. She carried a few extra pounds you could imagine her saying she had to lose. But they kissed lavish kisses like the ocean in the early morning, the way it gathers and swells, sucking each rock under, swallowing it again and again. We were all watching. Passengers waiting for the delayed flight to San Jose, the stewardesses, the pilots, the aproned woman icing Cinnabons, and the man selling sunglasses. We couldn't look away. We could taste the kisses crushed in our mouths. But the best part was his face, when he drew back and looked at her, his smile soft with wonder, almost as though he were a mother still open from giving birth, as your mother must have looked at you, no matter what happened after, if she beat you or left you or you're lonely now. You once lay there, the vernix not yet wiped off, and someone gazed at you as if you were the first sunrise seen from the earth. The whole wing of the airport hushed. All of us trying to slip into that woman's middle-aged body, her plaid Bermuda shorts, sleeveless blouse, glasses, little gold hoop earrings, tilting our heads up. Poetry is built from details. You all know the expression, God is in the details, and that's where poetry lives too. We can't pay attention to things generically. We can't love in the abstract. Actually, there's a Pema Chodron, the Buddhist teacher, said once that she got a question from a woman who said, I'm doing pretty well in loving all sentient beings, but I'm having a lot of trouble with my husband. It just came to me. We can't love in the abstract. It's in the particular, the specific, the individual that we can see past our general cursory impressions and sink our teeth into the actual. And paradoxically, it's through that very personal and particular that we most connect with each other. The Russian literary theorist Viktor Shklovsky said, "To make a stone stony, that is the purpose of art." What we are attempting in poetry is to get to the essence of what is. In the words of the musician John Cage, if art has any purpose, it is to help us become fluent with the life we are living. We live in terrifying times. I don't need to recite for you all the dangers to the environment, all the suffering that people go through. How should we respond to all of this? What are our responsibilities? What is important? What is possible for us as human beings? Those basic questions: who are we? Why are we here? Where are we going? The writer Vivian Gornick said, "Our job is not to answer the questions, but to deepen them." So this process of trying to deepen the questions is where discovery comes in. We hope to discover something that we didn't know before. To do this, we must enter a state of not knowing. We have to let go of the story we know in order to find out more about ourselves and the world. And as time goes on, I think this is why I gravitated toward poetry at the deepest level. I come from the Philadelphia area, a family of East Coast Jews, and in my family, not knowing is not a popular state.
My family is about being right. And I think that, you know, some part of me just knew that to save myself from becoming totally insufferable, that I would have to try to write poetry, because that is a place where you can never feel competent and never feel like you've really got the hang of it, and where the whole job is to enter that state of not knowing again and again so that you can be open to discovering something. Anne Sexton said, "Put your ear down close to your soul and listen hard." This necessity of listening is not only for poets. I recently read this thing that just knocked my socks off. The scientist Barbara McClintock won a Nobel Prize for the discovery of gene transposition in corn, a feat she accomplished, she said, by listening to the corn, learning the story of each individual plant. She found that where before she had seen only disorder, now she could pick out the chromosomes easily. And this is a quote from her. She says, "I found that the more I worked with them, the bigger and bigger they got. I wasn't outside. I was part of the system. I was right down there with the chromosomes, and everything got big. I even was able to see the internal parts of the chromosomes. Actually, everything was there. It surprised me because I felt as if I were right down there and these were my friends." Isn't that just amazing? It's an extraordinary level of listening. But even when we just try to listen a bit more, when we're willing to open the door a little wider to those three strange angels, we make it possible to discover something genuine about the world. The musician Stephen Nachmanovich says, "As an improvising musician, I am not in the music business. I am not in the creativity business. I am in the surrender business." And I think this is why I write poetry, to help me surrender to the life that I am living and to be more curious and less afraid. I want to end with this poem, "If You Knew." What if you knew you'd be the last to touch someone? If you were taking tickets, for example, at the theater, tearing them, giving back the ragged stubs, you might take care to brush that palm, touch your fingertips along the lifeline's crease. When a man pulls his wheeled suitcase too slowly through the airport, when the car in front of me doesn't signal, when the clerk at the pharmacy won't say thank you, I don't remember they're going to die. A friend told me she'd been with her aunt. They'd just had lunch, and the waiter, a young gay man with plum black eyes, joked as he served the coffee, kissed her aunt's powdered cheek when they left. Then they walked half a block, and her aunt dropped dead on the sidewalk. How close does the dragon's spume have to come? How wide does the crack in heaven have to split? What would people look like if we could see them as they are, soaked in honey, stung and swollen, reckless, pinned against time?